Blog Talk Radio.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, us amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest. I never took food from the widows and orphans, and never a
yeah.
Good evening, listeners. It's Sunday Follies. Tonight we have a special guest, Ray McGinnis. He wrote the book Unanswered Questions, almost like the opening song by Billy Bragg there, Unwelcome Guests, although Ray is welcome. Let's see if we can get him on the phone here. He's on there. Ray, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there.
Mr.
How
McGinnis.
Are you doing, Michael? Yeah.
Okay, it's good to hear you're coming in loud and clear. I only got your publisher blurb. I guess I use that BLURB, but I was reading it. It looks like a fascinating book. Dealing with the Family Steering Committee. This is the actual name is what is the actual name? Unanswered Questions and the Family. What is the name? The exact title.
The book title is Unanswered Questions: What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored, and it's about specifically about the dozen people who comprised an umbrella group of the September 11th families that lost loved ones on the attacks, which was called the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Independent Commission, and their shift from grief and loss to advocacy to wanting to have an investigation to make the nation safe, to learn whatever the hard lessons were, to have accountability and, move forward hopefully in an optimal way. And it's an interesting story of a group of people who variously were independents and Democrats and registered Republicans who voted differently in the 2000 election for Bush or Gore, but came together because they had one thing in common.
Well, that can certainly be said necessary today. I'll tell you that. Boy, the country is so divided, and you know as well as the listeners, spent $2.3 trillion in Afghanistan alone. It doesn't count for the trillions and trillions spent in Iraq and throughout the Mideast since the time of the 9/11, plus the incredible Patriots Act, I don't mean that in a good way, that has been renewed and added to, and all this, the revelations of Edward Snowden, the domestic surveillance programs here in this country, the drone wars, President Obama. I mean, this is 9/11, Mr. McGinnis, it's Ray McGinnis, listeners, Ray McGinnis.
Yeah.
Ray, in March of just a few months after September 11th, and the invasion, I think it was in March of Iraq, I wrote a letter to the editor, and I hate, it's always bad when you talk about yourself, but, I wrote a letter to the editor, which published, and I said back then, this is an international law enforcement problem. It isn't a thing of going to total war on a seventh of the landmass of the world. I mean, I've had real problems with this whole thing for 20 years, and I think the country's learned its lessons, but they haven't really learned the lessons, have they, Mr. McGinnis? They haven't.
Well, it's,
have they?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story to write about. I think, we're told, I forget who originally came up with this, but, if we don't know our history, we're going to repeat, we all learn the lessons of history, we'll repeat, the things that went wrong. And, and so I think that it's, wherever people are at regarding what they think about September 11th itself, it is a historical fact now, 20 years later, that the families, at least, where thousands of them were represented by this Family Steering Committee, and many hundreds of them rallied and, they went to Washington, D.C. They made a decision which is different than you might expect, because sometimes often when people have a tragedy and they've suffered a personal loss of a family member, most people, even if it's even if it's like, the Vietnam War or whatever, there's a real inclination to decide to grieve and heal privately. A lot of people don't want to be in front of a microphone, don't want to be talking to a reporter, don't want to testify before a lawmaker in Washington, D.C. They want to do this in private. So it's an amazing story that there were families that wanted to go and have an investigation, which most of them expected that there would be an investigation put together pretty quickly. They remembered the Challenger space shuttle crash on the 28th of January 1986, and Ronald Reagan put together in short order in just 5 days after the death of a number of astronauts a panel to find out what went wrong. And so the families were expecting that the President Bush would say, well, we've lost nearly 3,000 people. Let's find out what we can to make it right. And that just didn't happen. And so they finally, put enough pressure on that would go, there would be an investigation. And then the President appoints Dr. Henry Kissinger initially to head up the inquiry. And so the families went to meet with Dr. Kissinger at his offices in Manhattan, and they did some research. And while he was serving these dozen people coffee, they were asking him, want to make sure he had no conflicts of interest. And he was asked, I think, by Lori Van Auken, whose husband Kenneth died in the North Tower, we want to make sure, Dr. Kissinger, you don't have any conflicts of interest, you don't have any clients with the name of Bin Laden. And at that point, he spilled coffee all over the coffee table. Most of the women were there. They did what they're kind of trained to do as mothers and daughters and whatever, wives, and they ran off to get paper towel and clean up the mess. But, he blamed it. He fell off the couch practically and blamed it on a fake eye and then resigned the next day.
No kidding. Wow. Now, that's something. That is for that old geezer. Well, of course, Bin Laden, he probably knew them if he didn't have as much clients, of course. But go ahead and tell us. That's a very good anecdotal story. That's great. Crazy good. Go ahead.
Hey, this is the kind of stuff that, I was on September 11th, I was in, southern eastern California, Joshua Tree National Park, and at a retreat with 60 Americans from about 20 states across the USA, and off the grid, and no radio, no TV, just somebody called, a friend from the east, from the East Coast called someone, and so we learned about the attacks, and it took me 5 days to get across the border back on a bus from Seattle up to Canada, but, when I write about this, trying to find out this, I'm not a reporter, but I've, have written one book before. And so I'm trying to write about this story, and there's all kinds of surprises like this one about Dr. Kissinger. And then the families think, well, they're surely going to have, get some people without any appearance of conflict. And, then they have Lee Hamilton as one of the two people who they learn in time is, a best friend of Vice President Cheney, Dick Cheney, and best friend of Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and the Hamiltons, Cheneys, and Rumsfelds go away from time to time for vacations, and so there is some concern as they meet Lee Hamilton in March of 2003 to just talk about what their expectations are for the inquiry. They find out that he doesn't want to have any public hearings. He's against having that because he thinks it's dangerous. He's against having people swearing under oath. He doesn't want to have any subpoenas. They do get to have 12 public hearings eventually over 18 days, but it's just the kind of the inclination or the kind of the position that Lee Hamilton is taking from the start. It's just really contrary to what they're expecting. They want to have a transparent investigation, and yet he doesn't. He's mostly concerned with secrecy again.
You said. In your blurb, in your publisher's excerpt, they talk about this. It took 14 months for the commission to actually come together. That's going quite a ways back, but it didn't seem that long, but it was 14 months before they really got their act together. And then I'll remind listeners, after the commission finally published some findings, with this guy, I can't remember if it was a senator or representative, Larry Graham, I think is his name, I think. He came out, and I think he was part of the commission, and he more or less said that there was a lot that wasn't said that should have been said. Am I right? Did I get any of that right or wrong?
Yeah. There's a number of different people you've been talking about. Like, on the one hand, Bob Graham, who was part of the
Bob Graham was earlier on, he was senator of Florida,
and he was part of the joint intelligence 9/11 inquiry, where the Senate intelligence and the congressional intelligence came together,
okay.
And they had their own investigation. And I mean, he said that there, you know, it seemed that the government just was doing everything to, you know, just sort of stonewall. And then you've also got another Bob, who is Bob Kerry, who was named to the 9/11 commission after Matt Cleland from Georgia resigned. And Bob Kerry has said in the 2000s to a reporter, he thought that there should be a, because there were so many myriad oddities with what the 9/11 commission didn't bother, you know, following up on or looking into, he thinks that there should be a permanent 9/11 commission. And that's one of the commissioners who says that. So it's just a lot left unaddressed. Only 9% of the questions. The families presented, they looked at all kinds of, you know, newspaper articles, CNN, New York Times, Boston Globe, you know, papers in, you know, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and they put together these many hundreds of questions, you know, to be asked to Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, President Bush, FBI, CIA, FAA, and so on. Just let's ask the relevant, pertinent questions based on what we're finding out in the mainstream news to see if we can just, you know, get this sorted out. And the commissioners in March of 2003, as they started really getting ready for their first hearing, said, these are great questions, families. Thank you very much. We're going to use these questions as a roadmap to do our inquiry. And then at the end of it all, the families find out when they read the 9/11 Commission report that only 9% of the questions were really addressed, you know, hardly, and there's a few others that are addressed, but just superficially, and the vast majority are left ignored.
Huh, yeah. Well, so what are some of these unanswered questions? It might help us focus, the audience focus, because it's 20 years ago. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what were some of these unanswered questions? Can you give them away?
Yeah. Well, sure. I mean, one of the questions, I mean, has to do with a standard procedure. When you have a crime scene, and certainly we can all agree that what happened was a crime on September 11th, and a crime was committed, we want to find out what we can know about the evidence. And part of that would be, now you've got this huge World Trade Center has collapsed and, you know, into rubble. A proper procedure would be to put the yellow tape up around the area, and then to get as much of the rubble from the beams and everything, and get the forensics, you know, do the investigation about what that says, so that you can make a comprehensive report. But what happened instead was, you know, vast majority of the rubble, of the beams and everything, was quickly shipped off to China, South Korea, Philippines, other places around the world. Fire Engineering magazine, which is read by many of the FDNY firefighters of the New York City, had an editorial that came out in January of 2002 and said it was just outrageous that they're, you know, bypassing all the protocols for what you're supposed to do when you have any kind of a collapse of any building at all, never mind how this one collapsed. So, you know, it just is not, you know, not conducted the way you'd want to conduct an investigation. Also, the way that you normally have evacuations, most of I and you and probably most of your listeners have all been through routine fire drills. whether that was in grade school or maybe you were working in an office building. And, you know, growing up for me, every couple times a year, whatever grade I was in, we had fire drills. There was no actual fire, but we left the school and went out to the parking lot or the field and waited to go back in. And the same thing with several different buildings I worked in variously in Vancouver, Toronto. And people knew, you know, if there was somebody who was a captain involved in the volunteer evacuation drills, we knew that we had to get out of the building. We did, you know, and so yet when the World Trade Center was attacked, you have people whose gut instinct is, okay, my building is on fire. I need to run down the stairwells. And people in the South Tower and North Tower are encountering people with the Port Authority in stairwells with bullhorns saying, this is America. You are safe. Go back to your offices. Go back to your offices or you will be fired.
Well,
same kind of announcements happening on the sound system. And, people like Mary Fetchett, whose son Brad died in the South Tower, saying, like, if her son had disobeyed the order to stay at his desk, he would have survived. There's just things around, I mean, like, it's like big picture, small picture, like there's things around that whole evacuation. Many more people should have lived. You have the CIA director, George Tenet, is on a phone call at 8:50 a.m., 4 minutes after the North Tower is struck. He's at the St. Regis Hotel having breakfast, and he's on the phone at 8:50 a.m., and soon after that, he's talking about the North Tower has just been struck. And he, according to news reports, he offers the opinion that this the plane flying into the North Tower represents a terrorist attack by Osama bin Laden. So, fine. Families are saying, okay, CIA director, if this is your conviction, 4 minutes after the North Tower is struck, why do you not think to ask somebody or to get somebody in the CIA to phone the Port Authority and tell them, we believe this is a terrorist attack, evacuate the building. You know, precious time was lost by people, you know, maybe not figuring out what needed to happen at the Port Authority, but, you know, there were people that seemed to have figured out what they thought they needed to figure out and yet sat on their hands and didn't communicate to the World Trade Center people, you know, what would make sense to do given the perception.
Well, who did you, I mean, that's the first I've heard that they were telling him to go back up there. I guess the only stories I heard that I read about were the firefighters going up while they were going down. I mean, I did not ever hear that there were people with bullhorns or loudspeakers telling them to, like, yep, basically go back to your offices. Who said that? Do you know?
Yeah. Patty Casaza, whose husband John has said that, and there were other reports. From local papers in the New York area with stories like that. I think the headline was "Jackasses with Bullhorns" is what I remember. It's in
really?
My book. Yeah. I mean,
okay.
Surprising.
It's pretty documented.
You know,
you're saying it's rigorously documented. It's not just based on they found a human being that actually survived and heard him saying that, right? There was somebody who said, yes, I saw. Oh, wow. That's terrible.
You know, I mean, you've got people who are, like, you've got the experience in 1993, the North Tower, there was a truck bomb in the basement in the parking area. And in that situation, six people died in 1993, and many hundreds were injured. There was a Brooklyn, police helicopter detachment that came to the roof of the North Tower, and they were able to rescue dozens and dozens of people. I've seen different figures, and, you know, sometimes one reporter doesn't get it right, but, you know, 48, 56 people were rescued.
Right.
You have rooftops South Tower and the North Tower certified heli spots. So, which means that the Port Authority at the World Trade Center had gone to the trouble to get certified landing spots for helicopters in case of emergency. Well, certainly what's happening on 9/11 represents an emergency. And,
yeah,
and
right.
You have the experience, you know, 8 years earlier where you've had a successful evacuation of people to the, you know, from the rooftop to the street level. So you know it can work. And yet on that day, for some reason, although many, the expectation of many people in the building that the rooftops would be unlocked, the rooftop doors were locked and people couldn't get evacuated. And then you have people in the Port Authority telling the press, well, we were worried that, you know, people might come up and vandalize the broadcasting equipment. I mean, this kind of explanation, I mean, you can surely, you know, at a time of heightened security threats all through the summer, you can surely have security guards on the rooftop if for some reason somebody loses all kind of a sense of, you know, they see the helicopter and decide not to run to the helicopter for safety but and to survive, but decide to go off and vandalize equipment, you know, unlikely. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that this just is maddening for the families who've lost loved ones, and they read these kind of stories in the news and saying, what's going on?
That's an interesting question. I wondered the same thing when I was watching the second part live, or watching it live on the second tower, and I saw the helicopters. I thought, wonder, my first inclination on that was, I thought, well, if I was the pilot, how many people are in these top stories, and could I get off? You know, could I get people, you know, safely embarked onto the helicopter and get away without a riot? You know, I mean, I don't know what the official excuses would be for that, but that isn't it. That's an interesting question. You know, after 9/11 happened, there were whole schools of, there were whole conferences, books and books and books and books about 9/11. Many of them very skeptical of from different angles about, I think there was an infamous one was Inside Job. I don't know who wrote it, but it was, they basically claimed that it was an inside job that I don't know who, some nefarious forces were behind this. And they had a lot of people that were skeptical about why, how it came down and the works. Is it, how would you classify your story, your narrative, reflecting the families? How many families are in the steering committee, by the way?
Yeah, so there's a dozen people on the family steering committee. And I would say, you know, like, yeah, Jim Mars wrote that book, Inside Job. So I think, you know, the families, this is the thing, like my book is not a book about the 9/11 truth movement, which would end up being like a book saying, you know, people mostly in the 9/11 truth movement believe that there's complicity in the government. And that would be the book. But this book about the family steering committee is a different book because the families always were giving the government the benefit of the doubt, even though there were a lot of, you know, shocking things and surprises about how the inquiry was unfolding. And the families, I think it really, for the families on the steering committee, it comes to the point where the report only addresses seriously 9% of their questions. And so at that point, I think it fractures the kind of consensus on the family steering committee in this way. From the public statements I've been able to read, and there could always be more articles than I could find on a Google search, but I'd say at least, you know, four or five of the family steering committee members would be solidly behind the official account the government has given the American people and the world. Carrie Lemack lost her mother, Judy LaRocque, in a plane that flew into one of the towers, and she was involved in co-producing an Academy Award-nominated documentary short called Killing in the Name about Islamic terrorism. Mary Fetchett, whose son Brad died in the South Tower, was involved in one of the, exhibits of voices of the families, who these people were who died in the tower at the 9/11 Museum and Memorial. And then you've got other people like Sally Regenhardt, whose probationary firefighter son Christian died at the age of 28. She said that she thinks that there should be, some sort of like an institute for 9/11 kind of studies, just to sort of look into things that haven't been addressed. That's a more neutral kind of comment. I mean, Bill Harvey, who was, voted for President George H.W. Bush twice and for President Bush, a registered Republican, thought that the whole thing was kind of a whitewash. And there's many families that have, including members of the Family Steering Committee, that think that, there should be, optimally a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia, and are very perplexed at how three administrations have stonewalled and prevented efforts for a family to sue Saudi Arabia. I mean, in 2020, William Barr, Attorney General, came before a judge and said, we cannot release these documents because it will undermine national security and harm state secrets. And the families are wondering, well, how could our suing Saudi Arabia harm American national security?
Right, exactly. That, Bill Barr even is in this. Oh my God, that's terrible.
I think that with the families that I'm following, I mean, there are families who, four or five at least, who wanted the Jersey Girls, most famously Kristen Breitweiser, Patty Casazza, Lori Van Auken, and Mindy Kleinberg, certainly wanted, a new investigation, Monica Gabriel, possibly. I mean, Beverly Eckhart's no longer with us, but I think she would have wanted one. But they are different from Jim Maher in this way. Like, he's writing his book Inside Job and saying, the government's complicit. And they're simply saying, we tried to have an investigation. We lived through this whole thing. And it just never made sense, the way in which softball questions are asked people that, you want to ask the most relevant question, and instead you're flattering people with, comments about how nicely they're dressed as they come to speak before the panel. So they're just saying, a proper investigation was never done. I think Lori Van Auken and Kristen Breitweiser spoke to a Charlotte Dennett reporter in Vermont in 2009 and referred to the experience of the 9/11 Commission as, quote, political theater. And so I think that for the Family Steering Committee members, the ones that want a new investigation, they're not asking necessarily because they're certain that the government, the Bush administration or somebody else is involved in America.
Yeah.
But they're saying, there's so many things that are left unanswered that, for the sake of history and for the sake of knowing what we, if you go to school and you do an exam, you need to answer at least 50% of the questions and get them right. If you only answer 9% of the questions, it just leaves a lot of discomfort.
That's putting it politely. That's polite.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, well, the only people, I don't know, I guess you could publish you could punish millions of people, I guess, in the Middle East over this, but there wasn't really, there were no bin Ladens prosecuted. You're right about that. I mean, there was nobody, there were no public trials of people brought here, and they're from our allies, quote-unquote allies. I mean, that is a question. Well, they all died. You know, the ones that did it died. They drove, into the towers, and people are left about, well, who really was behind it? I mean, there was lots of thousands of dollars expended. Do you think Osama bin Laden financed all this? Well, then there's these new disclosures, I guess. Biden, Sleepy Joe Biden, released some papers, and Trump released some papers, and that I have not kept up with it, and I'm just sort of like, I'm still with you, you know. I'm just wondering what more can be done. I mean, what do these relatives think can be done? I guess is what I'm saying. I mean, we've done, the world has suffered mightily from these military responses in the Middle East. I mean, it's just what more? I don't know. What do the families want? I guess answer that question, and then give us more unanswered questions. I mean, you're right. No one really suffered, other than millions and millions of people on the ground in those geographic locations. I mean, what?
Yeah.
Help me. Help me, Ray. Help me.
You know, I heard that from someone that there's this new documentary called The Unspeakable that was William Hurt, the actor who's sort of narrating it, and it just follows four families that are still wanting, to reopen, questions around how the buildings fell and so on, and I think that for the families that are just there's just lots of really odd things that, you've got, unfortunately the Pentagon's hit and you got the people who were looking into, a great number of the people who died, 40 or more of the people of the 125 in the Pentagon who died just happened to be the auditors and financial officers looking into the missing $2.3 trillion in the Pentagon that was, it just makes some people wonder about, like, it's convenient, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, whatever happened to that investigation into missing trillions of dollars in the Pentagon budget? And there's just this sort of dis-ease amongst many family members that were close to the investigation. I think the further away you are from the investigation or having followed, I mean, the 9/11 commission wasn't broadcast like Watergate or something. I mean, it was really off the radar. Certainly up here in Canada, hardly a word about it. Condoleezza Rice was on the TV, but otherwise not much. Richard Clark, otherwise no. So it was really not in our faces to think about and reflect on. It's not really, if anything, the 9/11 Commission is really not a template for how you want to do an investigation if you want to get to the bottom of it and find out whatever there is to find out. And considering what happened on September 11th, that's a very concerning thing for the families that are, most deeply affected. And as I say that, I mean, there are many families who decided to accept the official account. So, I'm not writing a book about people who are all on the same side. And I had to sort of, carefully track that and let the different voices speak and, let the reader decide for themselves what they think.
So you're saying that go on to some more questions. Go on to unanswered questions, because that's the name of your book. I'm trying to I'm still trying to figure out why the Bin Laden family members, members of the royal family, other people who probably who were directly financing this weren't called into America. Would they even come if they were, asked? I have a hard time with this because I know a lot of people are, frankly, I think there's people who have just sort of like thrown it away. They just put it down their own personal memory hole. And for me, your book came, by the way, listeners, his book, The Unanswered Questions, came out just on 9/11 this year. And it's available on Amazon, and I put a link to it in the show description. And you can just type in Unanswered Questions, Ray McGinnis. That's McGinnis. And it'll take you to the book on Amazon, and you should check it out. I'm still, because it has, it really has. I know it sounds very callous, but it's the truth. It's 9/11 has really went way in the background now. I mean, people, I think, are for me, I'm still really in shock that we finally got out of Afghanistan after all these years.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's been a 20 years. I mean, 20 years, long years this has been going on. I have no objection to opening another inquiry. I just don't know how many people would care anymore. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think that people would start to care if they, you know, they read my book, or if they watched some, like, 9/11 Press for Truth, which was a documentary that came out in 2006, following some of the family steering committee members. And there's things like, you know, I mean, I was, you know, I couldn't fly anywhere like anybody else after September 11th, and finally took a bus from Seattle up to Canada. But the family members wanted to know, why was it that none of the people who lost a loved one couldn't fly anywhere, and nobody else could, except members of the Bin Laden family.
And
it seems that if without you know, prejudice, like, you know, maybe the FBI doesn't think that certain members of the Bin Laden family who are being escorted as soon as possible out of U.S. airspace back to Saudi Arabia had anything to do with it. But given the heightened sense at that time and perhaps worry that there would be more attacks coming, wouldn't it be prudent, at least, to ask these people before you fly them back to Saudi Arabia, do you know anything? I mean, what harm could it be, you know, in having a half an hour or an hour interview with different people? Maybe they do know something, but instead you fly them all back. And then you have Richard Clark with the counterterrorism group testifying before the 9/11 commission regarding this thing about flying out Saudi nationals, and says, you know, well, you know, somebody asked me, and we decided, you know, and so we decided to send them away and back to Saudi Arabia. And then a reporter from the Hill newspaper in Washington, D.C. follows up a couple months later after he's testified and says to Richard Clark, well, who was it that asked you, you know, to, you know, do this? And he says to the reporter, well, actually, it was me. I decided to do this. You know, I mean, normally when I say to people, somebody told me to do X and so, I don't mean myself.
Yeah, right. Yeah, somebody told me, you know, to do it. Yeah. Well, there's a chain of command. You think there'd be some paperwork on that?
Well,
Oh man. Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So, you know, there's things like that. There's questions that the families have about just the. There were so many protocols that were broken that day. I mean, Mindy Kleinberg testifying said to the 9/11 Commission, with regard to the 9/11 attacks, it's been said that the intelligence agencies have to be right 100% of the time, and the terrorists only have to get lucky once. This explanation for the devastating attacks of September 11th, simple on its face, is wrong in its value, because the 9/11 terrorists were not just lucky once. They were lucky over and over and over again. Is it luck that aberrant stock trades were not monitored? Is it luck when 15 visas are awarded based on incomplete forms? Is it luck when airline security screening allows hijackers to board planes with box cutters and pepper spray? Is it luck when the Federal Aviation Administration and NORAD protocols are not followed? Is it luck when a national emergency is not reported to top government officials on a timely basis? You know, Donald Rumsfeld saying, you know, he hardly got the heads up about anything until just about the time the Pentagon was struck. Is it luck when, she says, luck to me is something that happens once. But when you have this repeated pattern of protocols, broken laws, broken communication, one cannot still call it luck. And that's, you know, that's kind of the heart of the problem of there's this explanation that people are supposed to believe that all of a sudden everybody in every single position was like the Keystone Cops that day, and everyone just fell down the jobs and couldn't figure out what things meant. Like, they couldn't figure out maybe we should evacuate the buildings. They couldn't figure out, you've got the families were able, you've got military families who've also lost loved ones this day. You've got people who are connected to pilots, and they know. I mean, back in 1956, there was something called the Mid-Air Grand Canyon collision. 128 people died when a civilian plane, commercial jet, flew into a military plane. And there were a couple of other, mostly in the eastern seaboard, cases where commercial jets flew into each other in clouds and inclement weather. And the flying public needed to be reassured that when they got tickets and boarded a plane, that plane would not crash into another plane coming in the opposite direction. And so in 1958, the forerunner to the FAA was established. And now you have every single plane, the pilots in the departure gate have to get agreement from the air traffic controllers that they can fly at this altitude and on this route. And so this is in place. And the protocol is this. You've got pilots in fighter pilots in different Air Force bases across the nation who are routinely practicing a half a dozen times a month to go through the drill. Okay, pretend you're trying to intercept a plane up in the sky and come back down. They're doing this all the time, and they know how to do it. And there are general accounting office reports to Congress because it costs money, fuel, maintenance of the planes, staff time to get up in the early 1990s. I looked at a report of the incidents of the times that the fighter jets were going up to scramble to intercept planes that were 2 miles off course or more. 1989, 1990, 1991, 1992, over 1,500 occasions. And so, you got arguably between 1958 and September 10th, 2001, you probably got, 8 or 10,000 or more instances where you've had success. And this isn't like the Air Force is like some kind of a poor baseball team that's batting under 500 or 400. You're doing you're batting 1,000 all the time, and so for the families, it just doesn't make sense to just say, oh well, on September 11th we were 0 for 4. For many of the families, that's just not.
Well, there were some reports. I know there was audible, now alleged. I mean, actual audio reports of the planes as they were hijacked and then taken over, and the courses were altered. They even show the where the planes were at, where they altered the course, when they shut off communication with the different FAA towers. I mean, boy, this takes me back. I mean, I'll be honest, I was trying to do some research on your show coming up here tonight, and I went and started to watch I can't remember if it's Netflix or Prime, The Unspeakable, the documentary. And to be honest with you, I got through about 15, 20 minutes of it, and it was like 3 in the morning. And it was so gross. I mean, they were talking about retrieval of body parts and stuff, and of the different families you know, the bodies of their dead relatives, and it was unspeakable, really. I mean, some of the stuff I saw, I was like, you know, it took me back, you know, to the reality of the attack and what it really meant to thousands of people in the country who had direct losses from it in terms of the death of their loved ones.
I know
some people, you know, you're writing a book on unanswered questions. And I to me, it's like, I've heard so many people, well, there's lithium explosive charges or some stuff like that in the tower and the beams, and it collapsed. I remember it was so furious, even within my extended family, after 9/11 and the so-called 9/11 truthers that formed around this. They really sort of, in my opinion, gave it a bad name, and I got people in my family vehemently disagree with me on that. And they said, you know, that, you know, it was an inside job. And it was, I was like, I know, it's, you know, I tend to think that it's sloppiness. But your point about the Air Force jets having practice runs disproves some of that. They knew how to intercept hijacked airplanes, but they certainly didn't do them before, did they? On 9/11. No, they didn't. You're right about that.
Yeah, it seems from, you know, I'd have to go and check more about it, but I have been in touch with it, you know, more recently since my book came out, with a few former military and commercial jet pilots in the USA. But, you know, they've suggested to me that very few, if any, pilots were brought before the 9/11 Commission to say what they knew about flying a plane and these flight paths and everything. It would just seem that thoroughness would require that you'd want to have more pilots just come and tell the Commission what they knew about flying and everything about.
Right.
So it just seems that there's just an awful lot of things kind of left, a lot of rocks left unturned. And when it comes to the whole thing about the buildings collapsing, you know, I mean, I did read through the New York Times on the 12th of August, 2005, published 503 testimonies, sort of audio testimonies, the transcripts of the first responders of the Fire Department of New York and EMTs. And these 503 people have all lost 343 colleagues. And so they're only going to want to tell their superior officers, often with the FBI present, the real goods of what their own personal experience. They're not going to be bluffing or trying to exaggerate or make things, you know, impressive. They just want to tell what exactly happened. And of those 503, although none of them were asked, were there any secondary devices going off or anything, 118 of them volunteered that they experienced, witnessed, what they say, bombs, explosions going off in the buildings. Now, when I'm writing about this in one of the chapters, I mean, my view is, a thorough investigation would require that you get, you know, quite a lot of these first responders in there and testify behind closed doors if they need to for national security, whatever. But it would seem that it would be beneficial to just follow that lead wherever it goes. You know, I mean, people have said to me, if there were people who were connected with Al-Qaeda who were masquerading as caterers, the world Windows on the World restaurant in the 106th floor, and were rolling in with huge chocolate cakes with grenades inside them. I mean, like, I don't care we follow the trail. But I'm just saying that if you have over 100 firefighters in one of the grimmest times they're ever going to be telling their superior officers what happened on a day on the job, in this case, on September 11th.
Right.
I think it just needs to be paid attention to.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Well, there's also no question that you're climbing an uphill trail right now, buddy. I mean, you know, this is like something that people would like to put behind them. I hate to tell you that, Mr. McGinnis, but
this is
an uphill battle. It really is, to get people to reopen the book. And I appreciate you coming on tonight. I got to be honest with you. Your publisher, I'm gonna buy the book myself, and I'm gonna invite you back on and tear this apart over another show. And I'm very disappointed I didn't get a chance to read your book before I got to interview you. It probably would have brought back the reality of it, of just what we've left behind and how much we've left behind in the last 20 years since 9/11. It's an incredible experience. You brought it back. For better or worse, Ray, you brought it back today.
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, I'll just leave it with Patty Casaza, whose husband John, you know, died in North Tower. She says, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to fight for the commission is we wanted their words, she says, their lies down on paper. We wanted to make them go through the exercise. Even if it came down to the annals of history, the truth will come out, and, you know, whatever that is. And I think that, you know, whether my book, I don't know that I'm the 100th monkey with all this, but, or, you know, if there will ever be a reopened investigation of any kind. But I think that sometimes people want to read a history, and the family's efforts is an important part of that history.
Yeah, and there's too many, history, as we know now, is largely written by the victors and not the victims. And thank you for coming on tonight. I'll get the book and I'll hold you to it. I got your phone number. I'm going to bug you, okay?
I'd be delighted to hear from you again, Michael. Great to talk with you today.
Thank you. And the book is by Ray McGinnis, Unanswered Questions. It's available. There's a link to Amazon. It's Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. And there's also a Kindle edition available now, so you can get it and store it on your phone when you're flying. Ray McGinnis, thank you so much, and good night, Mr. McGinnis. He's from Vancouver, listeners, and that's one of the first we've got of Canadian contributors, authors on Radio Free Kansas. Really one of the first from Canada. I'll see you tomorrow on Radio Free Kansas with the United Nations Radio News Report. Thank you for listening.
And this is the only way to go here at the Go-Go. And now our show opens with one of the top recording combos from jolly old England. Let's hear it for the Dave Clark Five. Thank you.
Thanks, Sonny.
Right, fellas, whenever you're around.